Good morning. Good morning. Great turnout this morning. John, I kept seeing emails that Jonathan had to up the reservations, so I think a few extra people showed up today, so that's good. Having beautiful weather. Welcome to First Friday Breakfast Club, an association of gay men and the largest breakfast club in the state of Iowa. It's a tradition to do guest introductions for members or people that are attending for the first time. So if there are those that would like to be introduced, now's the time.
I'd like to introduce Matthew Duffy from Ames, first time visitors.
Welcome.
I'm Angelo. I'm originally from Chicago. I've been here in Des Moines for about a year now.
Mm-hmm. Well, welcome. Any others? Okay, well, there probably are some new faces, so make sure you introduce yourself and make them welcome. Feel welcome. Reminders, book exchange on the piano back there. Steve Person took care of that today. Since Scott is out, check out FFBC website is www.ffbciowa.org, and you can hear an audio of speakers as well as all the information and community things that are going on. There are links. Announcements I have on December 8th. There's a flyer on your table. 7:30 to 10, age-friendly Greater Des Moines at the Botanical Center. There's one handout about per table, so take a look at that and see if it's of interest. And Ken Hansen is going to speak about Gay Men's Chorus. There's a flyer on some of the tables, I think.
Hopefully you all see a flyer on your tables. I will be performing. We will be doing some wonderful holiday tunes, as well as some serious music. We have one of the composers of one of our pieces is going to be conducting us, and he is one of the teachers at Roosevelt, who wrote a piece for that. And there will be an appearance by Santa Claus, a version of I Saw Daddy Santa Claus, so if any of you have any, bear Santa Claus fantasies, you will be realized. I have seen Santa's here, and it is real. Tickets are available at dmgmc.org, and they will be available at the door too, so please join us. It's going to be a good show.
Okay. Dan Jansen has an announcement about Capital City Pride events, and there is a flyer on your tables, I think.
Yes. Yep, so on all the tables I've kind of put an overview of some of our upcoming events. This is not an exhaustive list, but I wanted to kind of inform people of some of the new activities that we're doing. I think last time I had mentioned the monthly tea dance we're having and what the tea dance was. The next tea dance is this Sunday at Peace Street in the East Village. I also wanted to make mention that we're starting a Pride book club. So the book club will take place December 14th. It'll be at Smoky Row, I believe it's 6:30. The first book is called Ghosts of St. Vincent's by Tom Eubanks. We're focusing on LGBT literature. So the first book we preset, the rest of the books will be determined by the people who are attending the book club. I just also wanted to make mention that we're planning a Pride Gala. So the gala will take place on February 23rd. It will be at the Temple of Performing Arts. Our keynote speaker will be Jean Malpas. Jean Malpas is one of the leading psychologists in preteen and teenage transgender children. He's based out of New York. I've heard him speak before. He did a special with Katie Couric on National Geographic about preteen transgender children. And he also does a series of TED Talks, so you guys can look them up. That leads me to the speaker series. So Pride is launching a series of LGBT-focused speakers. It will kick off in January. I believe the first one is January 25th. We'll be utilizing the Art Center Auditorium. So all speakers will be at the auditorium. Chadwick Boyd is our first speaker on January 25th. He's a TV host, food, lifestyle expert, and author. He has a TV cooking show in New York as well. I think he's based out of Atlanta. And his company is called Lovely and Delicious. And then, well, all the other speakers are listed on here. We have two that are to be confirmed in May and June. And then at the bottom of the page, I just kind of explained every new activity. We have some others that are not included on here, but I will provide that information as.
Well, they're on Facebook, correct? Or?
And we also have the community calendar on Facebook, so okay. You can go to the council by either website or
It is on your website? Because I was thinking I tried once and it wasn't, but maybe you have it there now. Okay. Good. Well, a lot of things going on with that. It's something different to have events all year. So there are people doing a lot of work towards improving the visibility and of Capital City Pride. So I think great work for everyone. Lastly, Primetimers, there's a flyer with a kind of a good-looking Santa on the front on your table, so you might want to keep it just for that. But that's the only place you can see these. They're not online. You can't get them on Facebook. But Don Jones brought them, and he said you can email him, and he can send you the list of events because there's only a few of these around. So his email is Don Joe Jones, DonJoeJones. So DonJoeJones@yahoo.com. Pretty easy. And they have a lot of events, so lots of things going on. Don't ever say you don't have anything to do. Next board meeting will be Wednesday, December 6th at the home of Jonathan Wilson and Scott Cunchio. Members are welcome, and you can email Jonathan if you need directions. Newsletter copy deadline is Monday, December 11th. And if you don't get the newsletter, you should try to get it because there's really some great content. We're getting some new people adding monthly newsletters, so I always can't wait to read it. Okay, lastly, finally, speaker introduction by Michael Thompson.
On November 23rd, 2014, Matt Martis LaCroix became senior minister of Plymouth Church. Matt has served Plymouth in various pastoral roles since 2005. In 2013, Matt completed his doctorate of ministry in preaching at Chicago Theological Seminary. As senior pastor, Matt does minister stuff, which is preaching, teaching, worship leadership, pastoral care, carries administrative oversight for several of Plymouth's ministries, and collaborates with the Director of Operations and Finance to guide the overall life of the church, which has around, give or take a few, 3,000 members. Outside of Plymouth, Matt has served in various capacities of the Iowa Conference of the UCC Church, United Church of Christ, and teaches preaching through the Iowa Conference Center. He is a past chair of the board of Interfaith Alliance of Iowa. Matt's married to Mary Beth Martis LaCroix, and who is an ordained Presbyterian minister, and who, among other things, leads the Saturday night band at Plymouth. She is quite a musician, I have to tell you. They have one daughter, Ellie, and one son, Will, and two cats. I don't know their names. In 2009, when marriage equality came to Iowa, Matt presided over Alan and my wedding at Plymouth Church with 200 of our closest friends in attendance. In addition, to preaching, Matt conducts the Sunday morning fellowship forum, which is in between both services on Sunday. The format is group discussion of any current topic that anyone in the group wishes to discuss. Matt has an amazing ability to take what has been said that morning during the discussion and provide his insight, which so many times has led us to a deeper understanding of the issues presented. He has that uncanny ability to find the thread that makes things make sense. But this comes from his being brilliant, extremely well-read, and possessing an extraordinary memory. Besides that, he's humble about it. So it's my pleasure to introduce Matt Martis LaCroix.
Thank you, Michael. I don't really know the person you introduced, and I don't think he's going to be here this morning, but I'm filling in, so here we are. I am so glad to finally be at the First Friday Breakfast Club of Des Moines. I don't know what took you so long to invite me, but glad to finally be here and to see so many familiar faces in this room. I grew up, I'm going to talk about this a little. I grew up in a very fundamentalist church, and they warned me a lot in sermons about the gay lifestyle. And if only I had known that it involves getting up too early in the morning and eating breakfast burritos, they somehow neglected to mention that in the sermons. It's a dangerous thing to put a preacher in front of a microphone. And I hope you don't come to regret that decision. But being here reminds me of the time when this young kid went to church for the first time. His parents were in church, didn't take him to church. But one Sunday, he goes to church with his grandfather. And he's so excited, and he's so curious. And so he's asking Grandpa about everything that's going on. They get into the church, and the minister says, "Now stand up and turn in your hymnal to 317. Grandpa, what does that mean?" "Oh, well, that means we're about to sing." Okay, and so they sing. And a little while later, another minister gets up and says, "The Lord be with you." And the congregation says, "And also with you." Grandpa, what does that mean?" "Oh, well, that means that we're about to pray." And after the scripture reading is read, the minister gets up in the pulpit, takes off his watch, puts it on the lectern. Grandpa, what does that mean?" "Not a damn thing." I am told that I want to try to keep it to about 20 minutes this morning and maybe leave some time for Q&A. So I'll see if I can do that. It's interesting to get invited to speak somewhere because I might qualify as an expert on some subjects, but I don't think it's anything that anybody wants to hear about. Certainly not this early in the morning. So I'm not here to talk about my expertise. I'm here to share a little bit of my story, because that's something that I've lived. That's something that I know something about. And because it is an unlikely story about a kid who grew up in rural Pennsylvania and in fundamentalist Christianity and ended up as the senior minister of one of the largest open and affirming churches anywhere in the world. That's the journey that I got to make. And when I reflect on that story, it gives me some hope for the future. So I grew up in what we call the Alabama section of Pennsylvania. Actually, that's something that James Carville used to say. Before he became famous for working for Bill Clinton, he worked on Pennsylvania Governor Robert Casey's reelection campaign, probably back in 1990 this would have been. And Carville, who is famously from Louisiana, after doing politics in Pennsylvania, came to describe it as being Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Alabama. I'm from the Alabama section. Grew up in a small town, graduated from one of the smallest public high schools in the state. There were 42 kids in my graduating class. And as far back as I could recall, my family attended the little Christian and Missionary Alliance church that was just down the street from our house. Now, I have to date myself to tell my story. I was born in 1976. Jerry Falwell founded the Morrow Majority in 1979. And the church that I was growing up in was a wholly owned subsidiary of the then ascendant religious right. Our theology really revolved around the promotion and defense of the patriarchal family. That's what we were about. One of the things that I just find so curious looking back now, once a month, you would come to church and get the bulletin, and there'd be an insert in the bulletin from James Dobson's Focus on the Family. And it would have, Q&A with Dr. Dobson. Now, what in the world does that have to do with going to church or a worship service? I mean, there's really no logical connection there except that our faith in that church revolved around something called the traditional family. And so that came out in kind of odd ways. That's how I was raised, and that was the only Christianity that I knew for a long time. So how did I get from there to here? Well, it starts with Hallie's comment. Dating myself again, but I was born in 1976. Hallie came around, anybody know? Every 77 years, which means 1986, I was 10 years old. The perfect age to be struck by comet fever. So I developed this massive interest in astronomy, reading books and making my family get out of bed at ungodly hours to go out with binoculars and try to recover the comet and that kind of thing. And it got really interested in science. Thought I was going to be a scientist until I got a little older and realized that I'm terrible at math and that was never going to work. But really enthusiastic about this. And then about 2 years after Hallie, my Sunday school teacher lugs the overhead projector into the cinder block basement room where my Sunday school class met. And he plugs in the overhead projector and gets out the pile of transparencies and says, "We're beginning a new unit in Sunday school on creation science." What he meant by that was science straight from the book of Genesis. The earth is 6,000 years old. It was created in six literal 24-hour days. Darwin's theory of evolution is a communist conspiracy and also has something to do with fluoride in the drinking water. I mean, it was that kind of a presentation. And I came home from church in tears. And I said to my parents, do I have to believe this in order to be a member of my church in good standing? And I don't know why. I don't know why. But the thing that changed my life was that my parents, who loved that church, my mom still plays the organ in that church, they said to me, "Well, you're so smart. Why don't you figure it out?" And they got me a couple of books. And that was it. They never told me what to think. They said, maybe you're old enough to start working this out for yourself. I have been trying to do that ever since. And the science stuff didn't last long. I concluded that Sunday school teacher was an idiot, and I'm very secure in that opinion decades later. But the books started a lifelong interest in theology. and in theological reading. I realized that, this was something that I wanted to go much more deeply into. At some point, I discovered that there are these people who are professional theologians, and they get to write books and teach about theology. And I thought, ooh, I want to be one of those guys. That's what I'm going to do. But I was still under the sway of this very conservative church. And where I was raised, you could not go off to Penn State and study theology. If I wanted to do business administration, they probably would have been okay with me going to a secular school. But because I was interested in theology, it was really clear that I had to go someplace that my church and my family regarded as safe. So they sent me off to Messiah College outside of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And for the rest of my life, I got to go around with Messiah College on my resume, which is always awkward when you're introduced to the rabbi and you're, where'd you go? Well, this was a peculiar place. This was a place where when we entered, you had to sign a piece of paper saying that you were not going to drink alcohol or smoke tobacco or fornicate. And if you're not doing those three things, I don't know what college is about. I mean, what else is there, right? It was a time of learning and exploration for me, and I grew in a lot of ways, but I was also living in a bubble. It was a very peculiar kind of a place. I did not realize how sheltered I was when I left Messiah College. I knew a lot about the Bible. I did not know much about life. After college, still on that academic track, I decided to go off to Princeton Theological Seminary in New Jersey. It seemed like a good place to take my next step. I don't want to oversell this. Princeton Seminary is a really unusual institution, and I entered in the fall of 1999, and it was not then an entirely safe space for queer students. This is, the church that raised me thought that Princeton was right next door to the gates of hell, that it was this scary liberal institution. But in reality, Princeton is a seminary of the Presbyterian Church USA. And in 1999, candidates for ordination in the Presbyterian Church USA had to sign something called the Chastity and Fidelity Clause, which was, it was a document that was meant to keep GLBTQ candidates out of ordained ministry without stating that explicitly. So it said that you've got to be married or celibate in order to be a Presbyterian minister in good standing. And of course, this was 1999, and so that didn't leave a lot of options for a lot of people. So I don't want to sugarcoat it or make it sound like I went from Christian college to some paradise of openness. That's not the case at all. There were real struggles in that place. But Princeton was the first place, to my shame, I admit, where I met people who were out. People who were clearly gifted and called to the very same work that I'm gifted and called to do, but who didn't have the opportunity to do it, at least not in the Presbyterian Church at that time. And that was eye-opening for me. So over the course of my 3 years in seminary, I entered still kind of an evangelical Christian, but thinking that I was academic track and I was going to earn a doctorate and become a tweed jacket-wearing college professor somewhere. But two things happened to me in seminary. First, I realized that I really belonged in the church. And secondly, I realized that it could not be the church that raised me, because my mind and my heart had changed on a lot of important issues. And one of the biggest was this whole question of the place of queer people in the church. And what responsibility do we have? And so over the course of my time, I converted, essentially, to the United Church of Christ, which was then and is now a tradition that prides itself on openness, inclusion, welcome, and justice. Not that you'll find all of those things perfectly expressed in every setting of the United Church of Christ, but we're a people who have been committed to that, and that historically has been the spiritual gift of that tradition. So I sought ordination in the United Church of Christ. I was called to a little church on the North Shore of Long Island and started there in the summer of 2002. 3 years later, I was called to Plymouth Church here in Des Moines. I had no connection to the Midwest. I had never set foot in the state of Iowa. What happened was I married a minister. And the two of us were persuaded that we wanted to look all over and see if we could find kind of a classic professional couple dilemma. Can you find two jobs? And we said, well, we're young, we're unencumbered, we can go anywhere. The problem was, at least initially, when we said anywhere, we meant anywhere between Boston and D.C. in the I-95 corridor. That was our world. My wife found Des Moines. She found Westminster Presbyterian Church, which at the time had a very dynamic young female head of staff named Amy Miracle. And my wife was finishing up in seminary. I was on Long Island. She calls me and says, I know this is crazy, but what about Iowa? And in those days, the job listings in the United Church of Christ were not yet listed online. If you were looking for a church, you subscribed to a service, and once a month they would send you this packet of all the open churches, right? The classified ads for the UCC. I said, okay, Iowa, here it is. I said, oh, okay, well, there's a church in the same city that you're talking about, but it's huge, and they want somebody with an earned doctorate. I've got 3 years of experience, and I'm 28 years old. And she said, just apply anyway. Just do it. And what I know now, but wasn't in a position to appreciate at the time, was that that particular search for Plymouth had been really frustrating. They had kissed a couple of frogs by the time that they got to me. And so when I got off the plane, once they ascertained that I had a pulse, they were ready to offer me the job. Didn't feel that way at the time, but it was really freeing. Plymouth has been such a gift to me to be a member and a minister there for the past 12 years, because Plymouth really has led the way in a lot of ways. But one in particular is that Plymouth has been open and affirming. That's the UCC designation for a church that welcomes all people into its life and leadership, regardless of gender identity or affectional orientation. We've been open and affirming since 1994. I didn't live in Des Moines in 1994, but I have to imagine that that was a pretty gutsy thing to do, particularly for a congregation that is associated with South of Grand and old Des Moines money, and perhaps can be mistaken for a country club sometimes. I think that was a bold move in those days. And it's been such a gift to be part of Plymouth. That is my story in truncated form. And maybe it's kind of arrogant to do this, but I feel moved to ask, what have I learned having lived this? Are there any takeaways, any lessons? I think maybe I have two that I'll try to go through quickly here. What have I learned from my story? The first thing I've learned from my story is this. Arguing about the Bible is a waste of time. That's something that I would not have said when I came to Plymouth 12 years ago. I think arguing about the Bible is a waste of time. A true story, one of the real lowlights of my professional life, I once debated Chuck Hurley of the Family Leader on the radio. I don't recommend that. That was not a very edifying experience. The Bible does not have much to say about GLBT relationships. I think it's important to say that because there are some people who've never cracked it but have heard enough preaching to think that every other page is gay bashing. It's really not. We're talking about just a handful of texts, and most of them are frankly irrelevant. You know, prohibitions of same-sex relationships alongside prohibitions of eating shrimp and pork chops. Well, okay. But here's why I say that debating the Bible is irrelevant. I learned all of that in college, Messiah College. I got really interested in New Testament Greek, probably because we couldn't drink or smoke or fornicate, and so I had a lot of time on my hands. And I took 4 semesters of it and then was a teaching assistant for 2. I learned the Bible really well in college, and I learned that there's not much there. That didn't change my mind. That didn't make me into an affirming Christian. You know what changed my mind? Meeting other Christians who were out. Relationships. That's the thing that changed me. So when I look at the culture, when I look at the work that we still have to do, I don't think that arguing about the Bible is a good use of anybody's time. The Matt Martis LaCroix theory of social change is that what we most need to do is to create safe spaces for people to be out and to be themselves, because the more people who are out, the more people there are for whom questions about GLBTQ folk will not be an abstraction, but will be as real as my sibling, my cousin, my coworker, my neighbor, my fellow church member. That's how people change. That's how I changed. And so that's the work that we're trying to do at Plymouth Church. The other thing that I think I've learned from my story, and very honestly, the second conclusion is probably half-baked at this point, but my congregation's going to celebrate 25 years of open and affirming. Is it next year? I can't do math. It's coming up. Rick's not. Yeah, it's coming up fast. 25 years of being open and affirming, and I think we're fast reaching the point where we need to pay that forward. We're going to start thinking about what it means to pay that forward. See, it was a bold decision in 1994 for Plymouth to become open and affirming. But quite frankly, I'm sure nobody saw it this way at the time, it was also a very self-serving decision. By which I mean, you know, in 94 when we became ONA, a bunch of people left, big drop-off in giving, like all the stuff you would expect. But the church also reaped an enormous benefit, because so many people have come to my church in the last 25 years who otherwise never would have darkened the door, never would have considered Plymouth Church, but they heard that it was welcoming and they wanted to know what that was about. And a lot of those people have become leaders in the life of my congregation and have given us so much more than we ever could have imagined. So from a strictly self-interested point of view, becoming open and affirming was a really great decision for my church. But here's the thing. 25 years gone by, being open and affirming does not make my congregation unique anymore. Every year, it seems, there are more and more churches in the Pride Parade. Have you noticed this? Every year, it seems, like another congregation signs up to, and that's great. And I celebrate that. But as senior minister of Plymouth Church, I also realize that this threatens my brand. And I know I'm not the only one who senses this, because we made our shirts for Pride this year said, help me out if I don't get this quite right, but it's something like, you know, Plymouth was open and affirming before open and affirming was cool. That was the motto that we went. Methinks I hear a touch of defensiveness. Right? There's a recognition that this is going to pay diminishing returns as a way for us to distinguish ourselves in Des Moines religious free religious marketplace. Now, I'm grateful that there are more and more ONA churches all the time, but it makes me wonder, who's next? What's next? That was 25 years ago. That was an earlier generation. What limb am I being called to go out on? And when we get self-congratulatory, when we start to pat ourselves on the back, if you'll pardon a preacher for getting a little theological, when Plymouth Church is so proud of itself for being open and affirming, it almost seems that I can hear the Spirit saying, okay, what have you done for me lately? That's the question that I'm wrestling with right now. I promised time for Q&A, so thank you so much, and I'm going to open it up. Yeah.
So today we might get a new tax bill.
Yes.
That tax bill includes politics and religion.
Yes.
So somewhere, you're a historian of theology. Can you tell me what happened in around 1954?
Yes.
That made Congress say prohibition against politics at the pulpit, and now they want to lift it.
That's a great question. Why and why are we even debating this as part of the tax bill, right? The issue at hand here is something called the Johnson Amendment. It's Lyndon Baines Johnson promulgated a rule, and that's all it is. It's an IRS regulation that churches and other houses of worship that engage in partisan political activity risk forfeiting their 501c3 not-for-profit status, which is incredibly valuable to churches, you know. My members can deduct their pledge to my church because we're a 501c3. I don't pay property taxes on a really nice property to the city of Des Moines because we're 501c3. This is an extremely valuable benefit. And what it has meant traditionally is that your minister is not supposed to get up in the pulpit and say, all Christian people should vote for candidate X, or should not vote for candidate Y. And this has been something the religious right has wanted to get rid of for a long time. There are, I can't remember the name, I know there's a big church in Sioux City that tried to be part of a group of churches that wanted to provoke a lawsuit so they could have a precedent, right, by explicitly endorsing, I don't remember if it was McCain or Romney, I don't know which cycle it was, but in the last two cycles, just get up in the pulpit sometime in September and say, you know, if you're going to be a good Christian, you got to vote the Republican ticket. And they were hoping to get sued, and the IRS was smarter than that and said, we don't want the test case. But as I understand it, and you know, this tax bill is really a moving target right now, but includes repeal of the Johnson Amendment, which should be a horrifying thought. I know there are people at Plymouth who have said to me, well, you know, maybe it'd be okay if Plymouth could be a progressive counterweight to the religious right. Maybe that wouldn't be so bad. I think it'd be awful. And the reason is twofold. I'll try to do this quickly. First, in my tradition, we really value freedom of conscience. And I think it's up to, I preach Christian faith, I talk about the values of my church, but it's up to the members of my congregation to figure out how those values should inform their vote. And when I presume to tell them, I'm crossing a line that I shouldn't be crossing. But secondly, it's a nightmare for, it raises the prospect of turning churches into PACs. We don't have to disclose our donors to anybody. You give a gift to Plymouth Church, that's anonymous. And, you know, just imagine suddenly, you know, I could get, we could get a whole bunch of new sugar daddies and sugar mamas who are giving all kinds of money to the church so that the church will preach sermons in favor of their preferred candidates, or maybe put up a billboard in favor of their preferred candidate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think the Johnson Amendment has worked really well for this country. I know that, well, I'll say this too. I will be political enough to say this. Yes, I will. I doubt the sincerity of the president's professions of Christian faith. I don't think there's a lot of evidence to sustain the claim that this guy is a devout member of any church. And I think that he views politics in a very transactional way. And he has been saying for a long time, I think as early as the run-up to the caucuses here, that he saw a repeal of the Johnson Amendment as sort of his way to pay back the religious right for their support, that it's really just that straightforward. But the Johnson Amendment has worked great for churches and for the country, and I sure would like to see it stay in place. And I have told members of my church, and I'll say here, that if it does go away, I'm not going to change the way we do things. At the church down the street wants to endorse a candidate for office. I'm going to continue to refrain from doing that. Sorry, Matt. But other questions? Yeah.
How did the Bible get to be kind of a God, a holy Bible?
Ooh. That's, how much time do I have? How did the Bible, I'll do this quick and dirty. We just, in October, we celebrated the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, right? Martin Luther tacks the 95 Theses on the Wittenberg church door and throws the church into chaos. Up to that point in the Western world, you didn't talk about the Catholic Church, you talked about the church, because there was only one church. Luther didn't mean to start a new church, but it, events spiraled out of his grasp very quickly, and he ends up seeing the church fractured and fragmented into many churches. And the immediate aftermath of the Reformation was a lot of war and suffering and death, because people were not accustomed to the idea that you could differ on matters of religion and still be neighbors. So Europe was ravaged by the wars of religion. In the 17th century, people killing each other over whether you're Catholic or Lutheran or Reformed or Anabaptist. It was miserable. But in the meantime, people look around at this and they're craving certainty. I want to know for sure. How can I know for sure? And so people start ascribing, you know, there are whole segments of the church that don't have a pope anymore. There's no guy on a throne saying this is the way it is if you're a Protestant. That's really scary. So the Bible becomes a kind of paper pope. Sort of an ultimate authority that cannot be questioned or challenged to supply the certitude that the Reformation has robbed us of. And of course, the problem with that is that the Bible is a big, messy, complicated book that says lots of things. I was talking to our young adult group at Plymouth last night about that bumper sticker you sometimes see that says, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. It's about the stupidest thing I've ever heard. You can only have that kind of naivete about Scripture if you don't bother to read it. It's an enormously complicated book. But I think that the thirst for certainty in the aftermath of the Reformation led people to ascribe more authority to the Bible than had traditionally been the case. The high watermark of that in the 19th century at Princeton Seminary, theologians like Charles Hodge and B.B. Warfield came to view Scripture less the way that Christians have historically viewed the Bible and more the way that Muslims view the Holy Quran, every syllable dictated by the divine. That's not the Christian understanding of the Bible, but we got there because people were hurting for certainty. So, yeah. Alan.
You referenced Plymouth as a country club old money. Do you still see it in that way?
Do I still see Plymouth Church's country club old money? No. I get into trouble when I make generalizations like that because I'm talking about Plymouth before I arrived. Be honest. I'm just poor white trash from the Alabama section of Pennsylvania, and they let me be senior minister. So, I'll try to do this quickly, but I've got a member of the church who is sort of a grumpy, older, conservative guy, and he likes to take me to lunch at West Des Moines Country Club and Golf about once a year and tell me all the things that are wrong with the church. And one of the times we did this, it was right after a new member class. And he's reflecting on the new member class. He says, you know, I look at that group of people, about 30 people. And I look at those people, there's not a one of them I'd give a job. That was a really insightful thing for him to say. He was observing that there has been a... my church is evolving in terms of socioeconomic class. I think that 40, 50 years ago, you saw a lot more fur coats on Sunday morning at Plymouth Church. And really and truly, I think that becoming open and affirming has made the congregation appealing to a broader cross-section of folks, particularly in 1994, when there wasn't anywhere else to go. And so people who were of different education levels, different social class, maybe didn't make as much money as Plymouth's historic membership had, wandered in. And they found a welcome they couldn't find anywhere else. And so I think that's our history. And I think we're evolving. And I'm grateful for it. That's a kind of diversity that my church needs more of. And we're still headed that way. I get the sense that I have overstayed my welcome. So thank you.
It's a tradition to give our speaker a copy of the Gay Men's Chorus.
Oh, wonderful.
Enjoy.
Wonderful.
Hopefully
Thank you
don't
so
have
much.
That copy.
I don't.
Well, the Reverend reminds us that religion delivers a powerful message that isn't always connected to reality. There are denominations, such as Plymouth, that are open and affirming to all, emphasis on all, where you can actually drink, smoke, and fornicate. Let's see. Oh, I was reminded by a member that today is World AIDS Day. Unfortunately, it isn't over. And as I looked down at my literally, my phone popped up, and on CNN it said, "Mom kept HIV a secret to her whole family, tested positive. When she was 18, says her name, world was turned upside down. Her mother revealed that she was living with HIV, and her family would soon find out they were too." So it's amazing that we're still having to deal with that. And so on that, the next meeting will be January 5th, where our speaker is Matt McCoy, who is here today. Let's see, and that'll be 2018, believe it or not. Future speakers, February 2nd, Carol Hunter, senior editor of the Des Moines Register, and March 2nd, Ann Seltzer, Seltzer and Associates, polling firm, very, very well-known woman. Now, very interesting speakers coming up, so hope you can join us, and thank you.